Good morning. Welcome to the March meeting of the California Water Commission. We opened the meeting today, and we'll start off with a call to order. Roll call, I'm sorry.
Okay. Commissioner Ball?
Present.
Commissioner Byrne, to be arriving, we hope, soon. Commissioner Curtin?
Here.
Commissioner Dalbosky?
Here.
Commissioner Daniels? Not here. Commissioner Herrera?
Here.
Commissioner Orth?
Here.
Commissioner Quintero is absent. Commissioner Saraceno?
Here.
Thank you.
Okay. Our chair, Joe Byrne, is not here currently, so I'll be taking his place. I'm Joe Dalbosky, the vice chair. First of all, I would like to welcome new commission member Maria Herrera. Welcome to the Water Commission. Next, we're going to go to the approval of the minutes, but I want to turn this over to our council.
Thank you. I wanted to make one correction in the minutes before we approve the minutes for the last meeting. And the clarification is about the item for our search for a new executive officer. And I want to clarify that the closed session will be publicly noticed as an agenda item explaining its statutory authority and purpose, but the notice will not include particular information about the interviews. So with that correction, we can proceed with approving the
Okay. Is there any discussion on this, on the minutes?
Move approval.
Have a motion.
Second.
The second. All in favor?
Aye.
Okay. Approval. Minutes have been approved. Okay. And we'll go to the executive officer's report, and Maureen, we'll turn that over to you.
I'll be doing this for Rachel this morning as she's across the hall at a budget hearing. First item on the executive officer's report is that Chairman Byrne and is currently testifying before the Assembly Budget Committee, number 3, on resources and transportation, on budget matters relating to the Water Commission and the Water Bond in particular. And Rachel Belante, our acting executive officer, is also over there assisting him. We expect them back at the commission meeting at some point this morning. And Chairman Byrne also will be testifying at the Senate Budget Committee on the same topic tomorrow morning. I also wanted to report on our executive officer recruitment. An advertisement for a permanent executive officer is now posted on the commission's website and also on the State Personnel Board's website. It's going to be posted through Friday, March 27th, and staff will work with chair and vice chair to select candidates to invite for interviews, and interviews will take place in a publicly noticed closed session of the commission, probably at the May 20th commission meeting. Also, we're pleased to announce a new staff member on the Water Commission staff in helping us implement the bond project. Her name is Jennifer Marr, and she will be joining the commission staff full-time effective April 1st. She will be joining us as project manager for the Water Storage Investment Program. Jenny is a supervising engineer and comes to the commission staff with 14 years of water resources planning experience. She's a civil engineer with a degree from Purdue University and is a registered civil engineer and certified floodplain manager. She has previous experience leading, planning, coordinating, and conducting engineering and planning analyses related to feasibility assessments for the CalFed surface storage projects. Yeah, sorry. The Central Valley Flood Protection Plan, the San Joaquin Basin-wide Feasibility Study, and the Statewide Flood Management Planning Study. Jenny was a member of the DWR-IRWM Stormwater Flood Management Grant Review Team and was a benefit cost analysis specialist for several federal emergency management agency flood mitigation and grant programs. As a BCA specialist, she provided technical assistance across the country for several FEMA grant programs. We're extremely happy and lucky to have Jenny join our team, and we welcome her.
Okay. Any questions? Okay, we'll go to item 5. And item 5 is commission member reports, and we'll have an opportunity here for any commission members who would like to report on any speaking and engagements that you may have had. Is there anyone that would like to present anything.
That we had or will have?
That you've had.
Have had, yes. Not in the last month.
I'll kick it off. I did attend the WELL conference in Palm Springs. WELL standing for Water Education for Latino Leaders. Basically, it's a conference to educate Latino leaders on water. And so I took some time to go down there, and they asked me to actually speak about the state water project, about the major infrastructure of the state. And so basically my talk was limited to how we capture water and get it to the regional areas. And that was basically the extent of my talk.
Okay, well, since we're talking about these sorts of things, I think I'm on. I spoke at the Urban Water Institute in Palm Springs, I think, and the American Society of Civil Engineers, Region 9 in San Diego, and the Wine Grape Growers Association here, and maybe one more, I'm not sure. Basically about the nuts and bolts of the bond and the requirements and the special issues involving dispersal of the money. So there was a lot of interest. The key thing for me was to let people know that we're not dispersing any money essentially until 2017. So, you know, it's time to get your act together and think it through and don't panic. That's pretty much it.
Last month I spoke at or participated in a panel at the Capital Weekly Annual Water Conference up here in Sacramento. And the panel was on the topic of surface storage versus groundwater storage. Really felt that initially I was there to talk about my experience in local groundwater management, but obviously the discussion got into how those types of projects might be addressed through the bond in the Water Storage Investment Program, and so it got into a discussion a little bit about process ahead for the commission. Not a lot of substance there, but it was enough that I felt that I should disclose that. So,
and I did have one other to report. It was last month. It was actually before the commission meeting in February, and I did speak at the World Ag Expo, which is the Tulare Farm Show, as people know it, to a group from the President's Ag Council, which is a large group of small farm groups like the Tree, Fruit, and Grape Commission and the Kiwi Commission and so forth. And the subject of our talk was the Water Storage Investment Program. Just a briefing on what it is and how that works, just to kind of educate them on the process.
I guess spending time in Colorado has kept me out of the limelight, although I did try to talk to my daughter about the Water Commission, and she had no interest in it whatsoever.
I'm going to take a short shower, and she'll get very interested.
Yeah.
Okay. Any others? Very good. Then we'll move on to the next item, which is item 6, and there's an opportunity here for public comment, things kind of in general, and then we will have another opportunity for comment later. Again, if you want to talk about specific things on today's agenda, so please.
Hi, I'm Joseph Rizzi. I'd like to talk to you. Hold on just a second. I'd like to give a handout to you. When I look at your first goal, it says serve the public forum for discussion of information and discussion of state water issues. And the last part of that says and solutions. Well, this is a solution. This is called natural desalination. And what it does is it's not regular desalination. Desalination, like down in Carlsbad, is extremely expensive. This is not. This is all about actually using the pressures of the water itself. If you actually locate your natural desalination field out at sea, down at about 1,800 feet, you get all of the pressures you need all of the time to generate as much water as the state of California ever wants. Not needs, but wants. 99% of all water in the world is out at the ocean. We need to find a way in order to capture it. Natural desalination is a way of doing exactly that. Now, I've been criticized about the fact that, hey, well, you've got this out there at sea. The oil industry has been out at sea for years and years. The water industry doesn't go out to sea. Why not? That's where all the water is. So I'm giving you actually a plan of exactly doing just that. Reverse osmosis has been around for over 50 years. The nanotechnology, the fiber tubes are extremely small. You don't need to have a pre-filter for them. They will filter out large particles just as easily as small particles. If you don't have a containment tube that you're actually forcing water into and actually letting the ocean itself be able to filter out and only bring you the water that you're really wanting. Now, one of the biggest things that you have and we need to work on is getting the water from Monterey Bay to the Inland Valley. The Inland Valley wants water. They're taking it from Sacramento because that's the only place it's got in order to get it. Get the water from the ocean. It's an endless supply. It's extremely cheap, too. There is nothing, if you're actually doing regular desalination, yes, that Carlsbad plant costs $1 billion. But it only puts out 500,000 gallons a day, or 50 million gallons a day. That's not anything of what you guys actually need. That's only 7% of what's going on down in Sacramento, in the San Diego area. This is all about actually solving your problems. If you actually take a look at it, if you have any questions, I even have a video about it. If you'd like to look at it, I would encourage you. If you have any questions about it, please let me know. Invite me back for a full demo of exactly what's going on here. I would love to do that. This is an opportunity for the state of California to solve their water problems, not just band-aid it, not worry just about the groundwater and how much water we have stored. You don't have to worry about what's stored if you're actually getting all of the water all year long from the sea. That's what this is all about. At an operating cost of under $20 an acre foot, you have a hard time getting that in most other areas. That is what I'm trying to ask you to consider, to look at. Contact me if you want. I'd love to come back for another presentation or longer time to explain this if you have any questions. All of these processes have been studied, and they have all been proven. Have they all been done together? No. But the reverse osmosis has been done off the coast of Sicily, and they decreased the energy output by over 50%. But the problems they had there was the fact that they were doing it in a containment within the submarine, and then they had to pump it uphill. If you look at my diagram, I'm transporting the water from the desalination field to shore using gravity, which we use already today, moving it from Sacramento all the way down to L.A., 700 miles. Then there's that one pulling that water up from the ocean. Yeah, that's 2,000 feet. Guess what that is? That's about the same as what you're pushing the water over to Tehachapi's today. You've already done that technology. You've been doing it for a long, long time. And there's a CETO wave pumps that have been down in Australia. You'll see them in the news if you actually look around for it. They're actually pumping water directly into a desalination plant, but they're pumping seawater. How about if you were actually pumping straight water that's actually already been desalinated? You've already got all the pressures down there. Why have to utilize the pressures on shore? Utilize them down there. Purify your water. Bring it up. 100% of what you use is pure water. That's what you want to be pumping. And so you can do the whole thing without extra fossil fuels and all these other kinds of problems. Please consider what I'm saying here and invite me back if you want. Ask me questions. I'm okay with it either way. Thank you.
Thank you. Mario?
Good morning. I'm only here for a quick comment because I was asked to provide this, and that was that, well, first of all, I should note for those that may not know who I am, and I'm Mario Santoyo, and I am the Assistant General Manager for the Front Water Authority. We represent the vast majority of the federal water supply contractors in the Central Valley. And it also encompasses an area that covers about 15,000 farmers, all that are, you know, having some very difficult times both last year and particularly this year, because last year, as you're aware, there was a zero water allocation on the east side for the first time in history. Never had that ever happened before. The critical aspect of that is that the eastern side of the San Joaquin Valley is all permanent crop. In other words, trees, as compared to annual row crops. And so it's a much more difficult challenge for farmers to be able to keep the trees alive when there is limited water available. This year, as you probably are aware, for the second time, they've been given another zero water allocation, the difference being that this year they're in worse condition because last year they had to resort to basically using groundwater because they didn't have surface water. So now there's going to be a deficit relative to groundwater going into this year, so it's going to make things that much more challenging. We certainly expect that a number of the smaller farmers, which is typical for the east side, you know, you have 40-acre, 90-acre, you know, 100-acre type farmers, their survival margin's a whole lot less than other areas of farming. So it's going to be a tough year. And so we certainly appreciate the work that the commission's doing towards trying to find ways of providing the opportunities to save water in high runoff years so as to deal with these critical dry years that that is being experienced, and not only in Central Valley, but the entire state of California. But the reason I'm up here, and I don't know if this was the time or not, but I know you guys are going through this whole process of developing different committees amongst yourself and then also stakeholders and an advisory committee and all of that. In relationship to the stakeholder committee, and I think it's always important to have, a broad cross-section of stakeholders, I was asked by the NECI Farmers League, which is a farming organization representing a lot of the eastern farmers in the Central Valley, that they would like to be considered to be a participant in the stakeholders committee. So if you guys would put that on your list of consideration, that would be appreciated. Manuel Cunha, who is their president, would be the contact person in that regard. And we certainly could follow up any additional procedures that we need to do in order for that to happen. But I promised Manuel that I would do that for him. Thank you.
Thank you, Mario.
Good morning. My name is Lauren Hajik, and I'm with the law firm of Kahn, Soares & Conway. We represent the Agricultural Presidents Council, and they are a group of regional specific commodity associations and commissions that represent a majority of agriculture in the state of California. They were integral in negotiating the bond with the legislature and the governor's office, especially when it came to Chapter 8 funds and the allocation of those funds. And they commend the Water Commission for putting together these stakeholder advisory groups, like what Mario said, with a broad variety of different stakeholders. We did notice, though, when the stakeholder list came out, that the Agricultural Presidents Council was left off the stakeholder group. And we would request that you take into consideration adding them to the stakeholder advisory group for the allocation of these Chapter 8 funds. Thank you.
Thank you. There's no others. Then we'll go to the item 7, discussion of the rules of contact. And I would like to turn this over to council.
All right. At our last meeting, we talked about... Is the mic not?
No? There we go. At its February meeting, the Commission discussed the need for a mechanism for the members of the Commission to report meetings they have with potential stakeholders in the water storage investment program. We've seen some of this orally this morning with people talking about speeches that they've given. And this is the discussion this morning is about developing a standardized form where people could, the commissioners could write down, you know, the contacts that they do have. And I want to be clear that while a disclosure policy is not mandated legally, it council feels that it would support the openness and transparency of commission operations. And at their request, we've developed a draft disclosure form, which is in everybody's binders. And at this meeting, we'll have the opportunity to discuss that, but I wanted to just make some key points about it. That one, the form, if agreeable, is available to all of you. Filling out the form or reporting contacts at these meetings is voluntary. And as counsel, as I mentioned a minute ago, I think that this does promote a transparent culture of communication of commission activities, particularly as we're involved in this large water bond program. And I think, as such, it's a good idea to use it, especially as we get geared up to prepare draft regulations for a formal rulemaking process. And there is a legal reason for this. When you do a rulemaking, anything that ends up in the actual regulation needs to be demonstrated in the record for the rulemaking. And so you want to be careful not to have meetings or information gathering that becomes part of the regulation that doesn't show up in the record. It's known as a concept of record exclusivity, and you want to develop your formal record for the rules that you're promulgating. And also, I just want to leave it that it's a matter of discretion as to whether and when you use the form or disclose. And if, in particular, if you think that contacts about commission business are an attempt to influence decision-making as a commission member, I think that I recommend documenting those contacts. But again, it's up to you, and the form is in your binder to look at, and we can either talk about it today or if you want time with it, we could talk about it at the next session.
Okay. Thank you. Maureen, anybody want to discuss this?
I just like to sort of find out, most of the contacts I've had or the meetings that I've gone to have been pretty much run through the commission staff. And to be honest, this is a little bit interesting here, to put it mildly, this form. But I'm kind of hoping that the communication, if it comes to me and I forward it to the staff, and then there's a speech arranged or a presentation arranged or a panel or whatever, that would sort of suffice for the reporting purposes.
That definitely would, and we encourage that as a means of handling speech requests and requests for meetings and things, absolutely.
Okay.
And then we do have a record of it.
Yeah, because it'd be awfully hard to keep track of everybody I run into walking down K Street here just to get to this meeting sometimes.
Well, I do think the intent of the form goes beyond making speeches, though.
Yeah.
It is about phone contact, email contact, potentially street contact. Yeah. And I think it's at our discretion, if I understand this correctly, whether or not that kind of contact warrants reporting on a form. But
sort of the discussion we might want to have then is at what point, I mean, you know, when's the meeting is not a contact really. But if you get to a substantive point about, you know, a project's specific benefits being communicated, you know, almost informally. That's the kind of thing you're talking about then?
I think so. And I think, again, it's a matter of just using your judgment about whether you think that it's something that ought to be formally documented in terms of the process. Because the process we're going through right now, we're in an information gathering phase.
Right.
We're very quickly going to be entering into a formal rulemaking phase. After that, we're going to be shifting into a pre-application phase, and there's different types of information exchange that's going to take place in each of those contexts. And some of them might be much more charged.
Let me just ask, for instance, there's a pretty clear definition of the criteria for projects and in the statutes and that sort of thing. So if people are asking those questions and you're simply reiterating, well, you know, to be eligible, you have to be part of these one, two, three, or four categories. And for public benefits, these are the five categories. Did these communications anything except sort of general information?
I think those are fairly innocuous. I think if you had the situation where they were saying, oh, well, that's interesting, those are the requirements, and then started telling you about their project, then it might shift into the territory where you would want to have it documented.
Okay.
Commissioner Orth.
I guess I certainly believe that transparency will be important in this process, and I think, like Commissioner Saraceno, distinguish this disclosure from the disclosure that we make when we're invited to participate in a panel or speak on behalf of the commission. And most of those things, I think, do need to be coordinated through staff just for consistency. And I guess I want to ask, there's nothing that precludes us at this point from being contacted and educated about a potential project, is there? I think the intent of this form would be in those instances to disclose that contact.
That's correct.
And so last week, for example, I was invited to participate in a site tour for one of the CalFed Record of Decision projects. I couldn't make it because of schedule, but I would think that if that's something that I was able to do, that would be a candidate for this type of a disclosure. And that's what we're talking about, right?
I think so, yeah.
Probably not walking down K Street unless it's a lengthy conversation.
You'd be surprised to get bushwhacked.
Don't say anything.
I think this probably covers most stakeholders that would approach us with comments or questions. And I guess it's going to take some judgment on our part also whether it is something that needs to be disclosed or whether it's not significant enough to disclose.
And if you have questions in any individual instance, I'm happy to have a phone call about it and talk to you.
Marth?
I guess I'd be interested in, you know, we need to have kind of a common understanding of when this would become effective. Do we start this now? Do we wait until next month? What's the general thinking about when we're going to start?
My recommendation is to start it now.
Okay. And we can, you know, have further discussions on the form if you want to look at this form and if there's something that you want to suggest, we could talk about that too.
So lastly, from my point of view, aside from reporting that, you know, this person called, this was the project discussed, is there any taboos of any kind beyond just reporting that?
I'm not sure what you mean.
I'm not either, but
people we shouldn't meet with.
Or yeah, I mean, is there any? You know, I can't speak for the rest of the committee. I don't even speak for my own position on these things.
Well, I think that you're ultimately going to be the arbiter of who you do speak to, especially one-on-one and or in a group, a small group, and who you don't. And there, I think judgment and your unique judgment is called for as to whether or not you think you should have that contact. I mean, I can imagine situations where you might feel like this is just really not a good idea, or it's a better idea to bring this person before the full commission and have, you know, a full-on discussion.
Okay. I have a question.
Yeah, Commissioner.
So when we're speaking, are we entitled to speak just as an individual in what our opinion is on water policy, or are we now always looked at as being representative of the commission?
Well, I think you have the prerogative in any speaking engagement to say that you're speaking your own views and they don't reflect those of the commission or those of your employer. But that said, with the spotlight on this very large grant program, people might just make the assumption when they hear you speak about water policy matters that the imprimatur of the Water Commission in this program attaches. So I think, again, that's a little bit a matter of judgment in how effective you think a disclaimer might be. But you certainly have the prerogative to speak on your own of your own views.
And if we are representing the commission, is that something that needs to be sanctified and arranged by?
We prefer that be run through the commission and in particular through the chair and vice chair so we can coordinate and know who's speaking to whom. especially from a geographical perspective. If there are requests for people to speak to people in different areas, it helps to know which areas are covered and which are not.
And what about water policy discussions as part of business groups?
Again, I think that you would be free to use caveats in that situation, that you're speaking from the perspective of your business or you're speaking your own personal views. If the business group was one that was a potential stakeholder for a project that we're likely to be acting on down the road, you might consider whether or not it's problematic to be speaking before that group. Again, I think judgment and discretion is going to be called for, and there are going to be an infinite number of permutations. And we're happy to help you make that decision or talk to you about it. But I think that there's not a bright line here.
Okay.
It sounds like we're going to have a lot of gray area now, and it's going to be a little more difficult to separate our business and personal life from our commission life. So we need to use our best judgment on this, obviously, in the interest of transparency, as Commissioner Orr said. So, yes.
Mr. Chairman, do we need to memorialize this conversation and adopt this as a formal policy by a vote of the commission? It seems that we've had this discussion a few times.
Right.
It would be nice to just...
Right. We have the option of doing that, as it was an item on the agenda.
What exactly would that be? I don't follow.
It'd be a motion to use this communication disclosure form when we think it's appropriate based on the nature of our discussion discourse.
You know, I would prefer to have our chair here and our other commission member, I think, in order to do that.
Sure. Could we defer this to the end of the meeting then and maybe revisit it then?
Either at the end of the meeting or next meeting, yes. Yeah, I think they should be able to weigh in on this. Very good. Okay, so we'll go to the next agenda item 8, establishment of ad hoc advisory committees. do you want to weigh in on this, Council?
Sure. We've discussed in previous meetings the need for small working groups within the commission to tackle very technical issues or controversial issues in small groups and then devise a mechanism for bringing their advice to the commission as a whole. And as such, we've already established 2 ad hoc advisory committees on groundwater and administration and budget matters. Staff was directed by the commission at the last meeting to determine what other subcommittees they felt would be helpful in implementing this program. And the 3 that are on our list are, well, the first one is legal, which would be a committee of 2 from the commission working to resolve legal issues that the commission as a whole is going to have to make legal decisions on. So we would present options to the commission, and then the commission would vote and take formal action. But the legal subcommittee would do the groundwork. The other is a subcommittee on the water storage investment program, priorities and relative environmental values of ecosystem. And those words I know ring true to everybody because we've heard the phrases so often, and we've really struggled with certain statutory construction issues. And I think that subcommittee is intended to work out and prepare some decision papers for the commission on that topic. And similarly, with the project evaluation process, the group felt that it would be helpful to have a small group of you that they work with to kind of develop an iterative process for how the projects are going to be evaluated, and then again use the advisory committee as a mechanism for informing the committee as a whole before we have to take formal action on something. So those are the 3 that we would like for the commission to consider today.
Yeah, personnel.
Oh, I'm sorry, I missed the personnel. That is, we are hiring a new executive officer, and that would allow a couple of members of the commission to work with council and staff on not just hiring issues, but any other personnel issues that might come up for the commission. And that's the one exception where personnel issues are under the Bagley-Keene Act. They are dealt with in closed session and under very strict procedural requirements. So we thought it would be a good idea to have that group as well, since we're actively hiring.
So the personnel committee isn't necessarily a temporary just for a selection of our executive director. It could go on to other...
I think we have the option of doing either one.
Okay. Commissioner Orth?
Question and then a suggestion. The question is, I think last month we... as a commission, agreed that the chair and the vice chair would be at least initially involved in the reviewing of the applicants for the executive officer position. So it may be appropriate to make that the personnel committee. That being said, I guess a suggestion is that perhaps we voice our interest in any of these to the chair and the vice chair, and then let the chair and the vice chair decide how they want. This is kind of how the groundwater ad hoc committee was done. There were several of us who expressed interest, and eventually the commissioner made the suggestion. So I think procedurally, I think these are good ad hoc committees. I can't think of anything additional that could be added to this, but perhaps we just individually express our interest and let the chair and the vice chair make the assignments or the appointments.
Yeah.
I think that sounds reasonable.
I do too.
I think that's probably what Chairman Byrne would probably like to do. Any other thoughts, comments? Okay. All right. Very well then. Each of you can submit your interest on this, and then I'll go over this with Chairman Byrne. Thank you. All right, we'll go to item 9, legislative update.
No.
And Casey's probably not here.
Yeah, we may need to flip that to the end of the afternoon agenda and move on to the following item.
Okay, so we'll jump over that into item 10. Which is an update on the implementation of the Sustainable Groundwater Management Act. And we have today, is Dave?
Thank you. My name is Dave Gutierrez. I'm with the Department of Water Resources, and I'd like to give you an update a little bit on the progression of our groundwater sustainability program within DWR. I'm going to cover a few items. One, I want to kind of introduce the strategic plan. I also want to reiterate a bit about what we're doing on communication and outreach. And then finally, at the request of the commission, we'll talk a little bit about the procession of the timeline of the basin boundary regulations. And I'd like to introduce Trevor Joseph, who's one of our colleagues and management members of the team, who will present the timeline to you. So let's start with the strategic plan. I actually asked Rachel to supply you with the draft strategic plan, so all of you should either have a copy of that or should get a copy of that very soon. And I want to kind of talk a little bit about what the strategic plan is and is not. I'm not going to go into the details of the plan right now. So first, I think it's important to understand the audience of the plan. The audience is essentially everyone. It's the administration, our agency partners, the commission, the State Water Resource Control as our agency partners. It's the stakeholders and it's the public. So with such a broad audience, obviously, I think when you look at the plan, it's probably got too much detail for some and not enough detail for others. And in fact, that's the way the plan was actually designed. It's a short document. It's about 30 pages long. And again, intended to be a short document at this point. I think the other important aspect to understand is this draft strategic plan. It's draft for a variety of reasons. One, we're in the middle of securing the funding to do the objectives and action items that we've actually are outlining in the plan. It's also a draft because we want input. This is our vision of how we're going to move forward in the program, but we want input not only from the commission, but from our partners and stakeholders as we move through the program. So the way I envision this is over the next several months, we've given a deadline of about June 1st of this year to receive comments back on the plan. We will be developing our project management plan specific to each of the action items over the next several months, and I envision to actually complete a final strategic plan in the next several months, possibly by the fall of this year, that will be much more detailed than this particular pamphlet that's in front of you today. So going over the plan itself, we have the plan laid out in various chapters or sections. The first is regarding the current groundwater conditions. And so the purpose of this is to lay out for generally the public and others to understand why are we here in the first place. What's the problem with groundwater in the state of California? Next is to outline the legislation and other drivers. So we're only focused on groundwater in our particular program. But when I say that, you can't just focus on groundwater. And I think we want to acknowledge that. We completely understand that. We have to look at this from a water resources perspective. And in fact, we're doing that, and we try to outline that fact along with some of the previous legislation that gives some background and allows us not to start from ground zero from SGMA. And so we kind of outline in that section. And then the next is the success factors. So these are some of the challenges that we've already recognized that we need to overcome, and we'll be working with our stakeholders and partners to overcome some of those challenges. And we want to get on a agreed upon challenges, and so we're asking for input on maybe some challenges that we may have forgotten or not included in this particular plan. Then finally, we get into our goals, objectives, and action items, and I'll cover that just briefly, and in fact, I believe we covered that in a little bit more detail actually during our last Water Commission meeting. And then finally, communication and outreach. We lay out a preliminary communication and outreach plan to kind of show folks how we intend to communicate and outreach. So this is basically the objectives of our program, and it's outlined in the plan. Again, during our last Water Commission meeting, we actually outlined these same objectives, and we included the specific action items associated with each of these objectives. So I don't intend to reiterate this again today, but basically the way I look at it is the objectives are we are developing a framework for sustainable groundwater management. What essentially that is as required by the law, DWR is required to set up the rules of the game, the guidelines. So basically that's the development of the regulations, which of course the commission will be a major part of approving those regulations. After that, it's all about assistance. It's all about providing that assistance to the local agencies. I think it's important to understand that key principle that it's the local agencies who are going to actually be managing groundwater at the local and regional level, and it's the department's job to assist those local agencies in being successful. I think I've said this in the past, the way DWR is going to measure our success is by the success of those local agencies managing groundwater at the regional and local level. So providing state technical and planning assistance, providing that financial assistance, and finally, obviously, many of the solutions are not within the basin itself, but some of the solutions will be encompassed outside of the basin, and therefore we're going to be providing some interregional assistance. So I invite you to look at the plan. I invite the commission to comment on the plan as necessary. We will refine the plan as necessary as we move forward through the program. A major piece and I think a major importance of the success of the program is actually communication and outreach. And I think we talked about this during the last commission meeting, but I think it's worth reiterating, and I think it's important for the commission to understand how we're going to try to approach this particular subject. And so it's kind of a balance in the sense that the way I look at it is you could have a variety of meetings. There's 100 different ways to implement communication and outreach. And it's our opinion that we need to get in some very focused discussions on various aspects and technical details. And so with that, we've designed a outreach program where we're actually going to meet smaller groups to really be able to kind of get into those details and get into the weeds on certain subjects. We also understand that there's a benefit for collecting larger groups, and that's to allow the interaction amongst the groups. And so we're going to actually try to do the best of both worlds. We're actually going to be meeting with several smaller groups on occasion, and I'll talk about some of those smaller groups, what they are, And then we're also going to be having some larger listening sessions. Even though the law requires us to do three, I believe, over the course of the development of the regulations, we're going to go well above and beyond that as we move through the program. And Trevor's going to touch a little bit on more specifics about how we're going to do that. So you've seen this slide before as well, but I think, again, worth reiterating. And so this is the way we kind of look at some of the communication and outreach. I purposely define communication and outreach separately. The way I look at communication, it's more education, and I'm more talking to you, whereas outreach, it's more interaction-based, and we're trying to meet with you and have a specific discussion. So we've set up, and we're not completely done with this, but we set up a variety of groups to try to leverage those focused discussions in a variety of ways. We certainly have our state agency partners. We consider the commission one of those partners, and we will be continually meeting with you all. I believe we requested, and as Commissioner King represented earlier today, that we actually have a small group with Commissioners Saraceno and Orth to work with us. The way I envision this to work is we're going to get into the details with Commissioner Orth and Saraceno, who will help guide the Department of Water Resources to get the enough detail in front of the rest of the commission without wasting too much of your time and figuring out what that balance is. So that's the way I envision this. I certainly encourage any discussion on that point if you all have a different vision of how that would best work. We are putting together a practitioners advisory panel. This advisory panel is basically a group, a statewide group, a variety of experiences throughout the state. And the purpose of that group is these folks will be the actual folks who are going to have to implement the plan. So these are the water agencies and the counties and the cities around the state. And we want to get into some focused discussion on some of the specific issues as we move through implementation of the program. Now, there's so many agencies throughout the state, so many counties, so we're trying to leverage groups as much as we possibly can. Good examples are AQUA, NAQUA, CSAC, NRCR, and others, where we're trying to meet with them also kind of on a smaller focus group basis. And again, get into the weeds and get into the details, and basically some of the same subject areas that the practitioner advisory panel has. In fact, the exact same subject areas. We look at these groups as advisory in nature as well. We have to engage, and we're in the development of developing a process for engagement of our tribal governments, and we know we also have to engage, but have not yet started with the federal agencies and their responsibilities, or I should say, how they will be involved in implementation of the act. And then finally, we have statewide public meetings. So the first is will be set hopefully at the end of April to get that overall interaction and make sure all have input to the program as we go through the program. So I think the next couple of slides will kind of give you an idea of the vision of kind of how we plan to kind of move through the regulations, how we plan to get the input, and the timing of that, and also the working relationship with the commission. So I'll have Trevor kind of come up here next, kind of explain that to you, and then I'd offer any answers to any questions or any discussion you'd like to have about the subject or anything that we've talked about today. So I'm going to hand this over to Trevor Joseph, who's one of our management team leads on implementation of the basin boundaries, among other areas that we have in the program. Trevor?
All right, thank you. As Dave pointed out, my name is Trevor Joseph. I am one of the implementation leads, and my responsibility, at least initially, is overseeing the implementation of the two regulations, basin boundaries and the groundwater sustainability plans. First, I want to start off by kind of pointing out our overarching process in terms of how we're approaching the development of these regulations, as shown on this visual here. We have a series of phases that we're using to break down the implementation of developing draft and final regulations. The first phase is all about scoping and really collecting and understanding the issues related to both of those topics. From the department's perspective, we really want to have a solid understanding of all the issues so that we can make informed decisions later when developing those regulations. The next phase is developing some draft principles and maybe defining some characteristics of what we feel would constitute some of the potential early content of the draft regs. Using this principles and these characteristics as the basis that may be then used to develop those regulations. As David mentioned, during this phase, we're also going back to these groups, these panels, and we're having public listening sessions, and we're reciting the issues and to these groups to make sure that we have a solid understanding of the issues, and if there's other additional issues, to make sure we can kind of collect all these before developing draft regs. So then that third phase is developing regulations. This, as David pointed out, this is where those required public meetings come into play. Here we're evaluating also comments then that we will receive after posting draft regulations. During the principles and the draft regulations, and then of course the final phase, we are seeking input not only from the commission, but also from the public. So there'll be certainly opportunities to receive input and want feedback during those phases. The next slide is just a breakdown of estimated dates in terms of when we'd be specifically engaging the commission. Those are all identified above the timeline bar in the orange boxes. Below the timeline are the public meetings or the listening sessions, description of when we'd be engaging the public during those processes, during the two projects. Both projects are represented here. The final two stars represent the actual legislative dates that we have to adopt the regulations. That January 1st, 2016 is the due date for basin boundary regs. And then, of course, June 1st, 2016 is the date for groundwater sustainability regulations. So this process that I showed on the previous slide is kind of embedded in this timeline. And you were kind of moving between those boxes as we're completing the phases. So this is our timeline. We have the red boxes are finally going back to the Office of Administrative Law and then going through the actual final rulemaking administrative process with that agency. Are there any questions at this point on the timeline? I know there's kind of a lot of detail on the timeline. It might take some time to study that to really understand how those pieces are interrelated, how the phases are embedded in these dates.
Commissioner Saraceno.
There's been some discussion about the role of OAL with these emergency regulations. Could you elaborate on the process there as opposed to what we went through with the other regulations we adopted?
Yeah, so, I mean, we met with OAL early this calendar year. And as you pointed out, these are emergency regulations, which allow a lot of, dare I say, flexibility, but more of a streamlined administrative process with that agency. So we met with AOAL. They are not providing a formal review, if you will, of the content of the regulations. They assured us that is not, as it they understand it, their role. They certainly have to look at the content for incorporation of the regs into the state process. But as it relates to the actual content, the content as it relates to the topics of basin boundaries and groundwater sustainability plans, they do not intend to review that content per se for the sake of that issue, of understanding those issues. It's more of an administrative role is what they've discussed with us.
Commissioner Orth.
I appreciate this, and actually, as a member of the ad hoc subcommittee, I've had an opportunity to look at this several times, and something grabs my attention this morning that, just for emphasis and clarity, at the very bottom of that in the blue arrow, you have input from advisory panels, and I believe the intent is in the broader context, more than just the practitioner panel, but all of the caucuses and special groups that you plan to meet with. So just again emphasize that in addition to these public listening sessions and public comment periods, that the intent is this interactive, iterative relationship with the various practitioner interested stakeholder groups that you've identified in that previous slide, right?
Yeah, no, that's correct. I mean, I kind of went over this quickly, but the internal project scoping, we've had a lot of meetings with different groups early on, again, to kind of understand the issues. We plan to go out to those same groups after we develop principles and kind of start to get around some of the characteristics, same groups, the panels, the groups that David mentioned, and engage them again. You know, what are your thoughts? Did we get the issues down right? Did we understand you correctly? Are there other issues? What is your thinking of the principles we develop? Would this make a strong basis for developing regulations or not? And then again, same type of process with the draft regulations. This is a little bit more formal because that's what's laid out in the legislation, meaning that we have to post them. 30 days later, we have to have the legislative mandated public meetings. We intend to use those same venues that we ultimately meet with the public during our listening sessions. Again, that was what David mentioned. It's a little above and beyond what's in the legislation, but we plan to try to hit those same spots throughout the state so we have a lot of consistency and so that folks can come in and then give us some of their feedback and input on the draft regs.
Yeah, Commissioner Herrera.
I just had a question on you were discussing the practitioner advisory panel, and there were some examples provided of who would be part of those of that panel, including counties and cities. And you know, one of the questions that I had was whether or not there was going to be any sort of effort made to also include the special districts, such as community services districts, public utility districts, which you know are reliant right now on groundwater and supplying water to communities. Another stakeholder, private well owners. There's a significant amount of private well owners that I'm sure are very interested in sort of engaging in these discussions and understanding how this act will impact them. I'm just wondering.
Yeah, that kind of gets to Dave's points on how we're approaching communication and outreach in general. And so I'll let Dave answer that one.
Okay, so that's a very good question. I think what we're trying to do is we're trying to balance these groups in the sense that we're trying to get it down to a small enough size that we can actually get into a very focused discussion, and also a focus group to get into the focus of the discussion. However, we are absolutely interested in getting all groups' input. And so what we're trying to do is we're trying to reach out. So the Practitioners Advisory Committee, I think it should our panel, it should be realized that that's just one more advisory group that we're actually going to in a different format. There's nothing special about that advisory group compared to the other advisory groups we're going to. And so if we don't have them picked up in this particular group, we fully intend to get those groups identified and engaged in other groups. And there are certain groups that we actually have not yet engaged. And it's not that we haven't tried, we are trying. But the key is we're trying to actually leverage the groups. A good example would be the ag community. I've been in contact with various components of the ag community. And what I'm trying to do is get that group together so that we could actually leverage a group and be as efficient as possible in getting their input, but also making it efficient and not having to meet with, you know, maybe 50 or 60 different parties of that group. So we're not quite there yet. We don't have all of them identified yet, but we have been out there quite a bit. We've met with dozens and dozens of various groups to begin acknowledging the issues. And the key is what we're trying to do is get a basic common understanding of the issues. So we'll still need to work on your question.
Yes, I would just encourage you to consider getting at least one or two representatives on the actual panel that's a little bit more involved rather than just perhaps waiting to get their input during public meetings. I think traditionally that is the way that those sort of groups have been asked to engage in the past, just during public meetings. And I think that there's a lot of interest to play more of a formal role. So I hope that there's a way that you could facilitate that.
We will do our best to do that, and we are trying our hardest to engage as many groups as possible. We'll identify some of those, and we'll start working on that.
All right, thank you.
Any additional questions?
Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. I apologize for being late. I assume that moves us to item number 11 on the agenda, which is update on program administrative activities for water storage investment program. Ms. Jenny Marr. Oh, I'm sorry. Okay, good. We're still doing groundwater. I do see another presentation in the packet. I was wondering if we had already blown through that or not, but
Commissioners, I'm David Bolin with the Association of California Water Agencies. We appreciate being asked to present as well on groundwater and the implementation of the Act. We appreciated very much the work with the department staff, the fact that they've been reaching out to a lot of different groups, including an AQUA policy committee that we've had assembled now for a while on implementation challenges. I wanted to just focus my points here on the GSA formation challenge, which is the first big hurdle I think we're facing with the Act. First of all, just as an overview of just who we are, I'm pretty sure you're all aware that the Association of California Water Agencies is essentially representing the districts, the special districts, and public water agencies in the state, many of which do have groundwater responsibilities. On the overview, in terms of what we're where we're at right now, I wanted to underscore two deadlines. One, of course, is the establishment of the GSAs, which is on September 30th, 2017. It seems like a long ways out there, but it's not. It's an extremely tight deadline that we're facing here in terms of organizing ourselves into these GSAs. And then the other one that's even more pending, and I appreciate Trevor Joseph and his presentation on the boundaries issue, basin boundary regulations. At first, you might think, well, what's that got to do with GSA formation? And the point I want to try to get across, if nothing else in my presentation, is that they're extremely interrelated and that the governance questions have everything to do with geography and focus on boundaries. The GSAs are formed by local public water agencies that have water supply, water management, and land use responsibilities. And that includes counties and cities and all kinds of different types of special districts that have responsibilities that overlap and then in many cases are managing surface and groundwater and different parts of the geography of our state here. And, of course, the focus for our challenge is on the priority basins that have been designated as part of the CASGEM program of the 515 alluvial basins in the state. 127 of them are designated high and medium priority, and that's the focus primarily in the Central Valley, but then also some of the alluvial basins in other parts of the state. So counties are presumed to be GSAs if no other GSAs are formed. This is trying to get at the problem of the unmanaged areas, the fragments of areas that are not currently represented in special districts. Boundaries are extremely important. Both the basin boundaries themselves, which are essentially an existing hierarchy of these alluvial areas of the state that were used in California groundwater management planning in the past, and then were essentially deputized to the project of doing groundwater management planning. So those boundaries don't necessarily represent current management areas. And then, of course, the jurisdictions themselves and their boundaries. And that's an extremely important concept that the basins and the jurisdictions don't necessarily align. There are new authorities and tools in the Act. There's new participants, particularly the cities and counties, many of which have not really been involved in water management or have been involved in a more land use planning kind of level. And some of these folks need to be brought to the table to be a part of this project. And then, of course, a lot of diverse interests represented by these elected public agency officials, but which have their own sets of circumstances. And the obvious one is agricultural interests. There are a lot of rural communities that are very dependent on groundwater, and they're in various states of organization. And of course, there are a lot of other interests that have concern about how groundwater is managed in California. Their local control is the premise of the Act, and that means that the locals have to do this. This is a project that the state cannot impose on the locals. However, there are backstops, and there are results if they are unable to organize by that 2017 date. And then the other point that I'd like to underscore is the fact that we can empower these agencies, these organizations to form, and we can empower them for by way of outreach and education, policy clarity and flexibility, various tools that can be provided, including facilitation and funding. So just the conceptual steps in forming GSA, this is material that's been out there sort of at a concept level. The idea that you need to identify your base and boundaries right off the bat, that's the first question. Where are your basins? And then, of course, working, identifying with the local, what local agencies are involved in those areas, understanding the available resources, identifying involved stakeholders, and then evaluating your authorities, and then evaluating and proposing a governance model. And this is all very linear and very crisp and very wonderful in concept. The difficulty is we're dealing with existing forms of governance and existing relationships and all kinds of complexity at a political as well as technical level. So GSA conceptual models, there's conceptually, again, you could form a GSA on a basin scale, just one, and then build one plan for it. Or you'll have multiple GSAs in a basin and then maybe one plan. Or you might have multiple GSAs and multiple plans, and they all have to work through a coordinating agreement. And that's probably the more likely scenario in most areas. Publication and notice is required. Exclusive agencies are listed in the Act. There's notice of intent to the department, and they've got a website up, and they're already receiving notices from various entities that want to be the GSAs. And then there's a question of what happens if there's overlap. What if several competitive GSA proposals are put in, and there's a little bit of ambiguity there? Considering beneficial interests of the users of groundwater needs to be a fundamental aspect of forming these GSAs, and then the GSAs themselves need to maintain an interested persons list to make sure they incorporate these interests and groups in. I'm not going to touch the detail on this boundary regulation stuff. There's a lot of detail here. Trevor also touched on it. He gave a great timeline. It's extremely condensed. We want lots of due process. We appreciate the idea that they are reaching out to a lot of different interests and hearing all the different complexities associated with it. But suffice to say that the methodology and criteria need to be established by the department through this rulemaking process, which will then allow some of these entities to change the boundaries of these existing 515 basins in the state, probably with most of the focus on the 127 high and medium basins, and move those boundaries around as needed to make them fit with a right governance sort of model. As an example, I just got a little snapshot here of Butte County and kind of surrounding counties and some of the overlapping or the relationship of some of the basins in that area. This is actually a simple part of the state. The reason I picked it was that it has relatively large, small numbers of polygons. When you start superimposing the polygons of the jurisdictional boundaries, all the existing special districts that are out in these areas, all the cities and the counties, and of course we've got the counties, but if you superimpose the cities and then the special districts, you have an extremely complex puzzle that needs to be worked up as to what the right approach is to forming these GSAs. We do need to consider geological and hydrological conditions in the decisions about whether or not to move boundaries of these basins. And then the political boundaries and governance relationships are underscored already in the law, and that needs to be a consideration. So puzzles, putting puzzle pieces together. We did AQUA as well as RCRC and the counties, Association of Counties and the California Water Foundation put together a series of workshops where we actually teed this issue up in Willows and Tulare and Modesto at a regional scale. We got a lot of great input, a lot of great participation. Many supervisors from counties were present. A lot of city elected, you know, council people were there as well, which was very heartening. And we already know that they're evaluating their current conditions and management plans. They're identifying information gaps and capacity needs, and there are great capacity needs. Lack of capacity to actually do this work. And then looking at governance structures and forming partnerships, and there are already folks that are trying to make decisions out there. We do know that there are local meetings being held at the county and basin level, and that they are being convened by some of the potential GSA agencies, but they're also reaching out to private water companies, private well owners and ag, as well as rural residential owners, and then these groups that are representing various interests, local stakeholders, including the farm bureaus, growers, RCDs, environmental justice and conservation groups, many of which have been involved in integrated regional water management planning in the past, which is a tool that you've heard about and we've been funding for a while now, and it's been a great opportunity to try to take some of the relationships that have been established through that process and try to apply them to this project. But they are not interchangeable necessarily, and those are not necessarily going to be the types of relationships that will crystallize as the GSAs. So the tasks at hand listed here, assessing groundwater technical information, looking at different kinds of governance authorities, MOUs, joint powers, different kinds of contracts to organize themselves, and then also considering the types of powers that they will be exercising. This, again, is a menu of powers. Not all of these GSAs are going to pick all of these powers and execute. And there are a lot of, as you can imagine, political and economic considerations in these areas that need to be addressed. And then, of course, facilitation and conflict resolution needs. And we're anticipating that there will be a fair amount of need for those services, unfortunately, the way governance works in our state. So action at the local level, I just wanted to underscore what's happening in different parts of the state, really just touch on that. The orange and yellow on here are the medium and high areas, and then the little crosshatch is the adjudicated basins that are have a kind of a parallel process. The focus is not really on them right now because they're able to kind of package what they're already doing and make that a functional equivalent. But Yolo County basins, they're already planning, or they've got several structures, a lot of kind of infrastructure that they're able to leverage there, and they are looking at using a partnership with the Farm Bureau to talk about how to structure their GSA. The Modesto Basin, again, they have an association. They're considering that as a potential GSA in their area. It happens to align nicely with the boundary of the basin. The Cahuilla Basin, they have a water commission, and it's made up of a lot of different representatives that report to the supervisors, and they're looking at that as a tool. Kern County Basins, they have an authority that they put together about a year and a half or so ago that happens to have the county boundary as its area, but there's a lot of need for coordinating within the county. And then the Coachella Basins have a management group. So they're all with different kinds of models looking at what they're doing. Just a kind of a honing in on these each of these areas. The Yolo County group has a great network, like I say, of sensors. They have an existing model. They have a current 30-30 plan, and they're developing this forum to try to figure out how to leverage all of those resources into a GSA approach. The Modesto Basin, they have this association. They have a little map there. It's kind of hard to read, but it really shows the outside boundaries of the basin are nicely aligned with some of the existing special districts. However, there are some areas that are white off to the right or off to the eastern side of the basin that are not organized currently and are unmanaged areas. And that's been some concern on various fronts. And then this is just a subunit of the Stanislaus County area. There's a piece of the county that goes north of this map, and that is being considered as part of San Joaquin. And potentially cooperating with another county, which is a bit of a challenge. And then there's an area to the west of the San Joaquin River that's being looked at as a separate management area as well. The Cahuilla Basin, they have a bunch of different entities. And again, they have existing plans. They have a lot of public and private water suppliers that are part of an association. And then they are looking at organizing that group into a GSA. And then the Kern Basins, the green area represents the authority boundaries. There are some areas like the city of Bakersfield, which is within that area, that is not yet part of this association. They are, again, looking at coordinating their GSA in sort of a tiered approach, and then maybe having smaller GSAs that would manage plans and then report up to this coordinating entity. That will be a challenge, as you can imagine. The local example of Coachella Valley basins, these are some, the pictures here are some recharge basins out on an alluvial fan there. They are, again, trying to leverage existing management relationships They already are cooperatively fulfilling a CASGEM monitoring role, and so they're looking at trying to form a GSA out of that relationship. So in summary, the immediate challenge is to continue the outreach and education. And this is targeted not just to the commission or to the department or to AQUA. This is our corporate responsibility here at the state level, that all of us in state government, as well as in parts of local government and all the various entities, the counties, the cities, and all the different interest groups are working together to do a lot of outreach and education. A lot of people are doing lots of speeches like this around the state at different scales, statewide as well as down to the local community scale. But there needs to be also a focus not just on the high and medium basins, but on the low and very low basins as well, because all of them need to do some groundwater management. We need to look at flexible boundary regulations that provide for responsive and consistent administration. I think that's one of the biggest challenges, is that we need the rules to be established quickly, but they also need to be flexible and fairly simple. And then that will help these decision makers at the local level figure out how they're going to do their GSA formation and make their commitments. And that all needs to happen basically this year, so that in 2016 they can be committing themselves to these relationships. And then, of course, addressing formation conflicts proactively. And that will be a responsibility, again, at the local level to identify conflict and face it head on. But there may need to be some opportunities for intervention and I guess you call it technical assistance to try to help move areas that are seemingly in deadlock to a point where they're successful. Because the downside to them not meeting the deadline, of course, is that the State Water Board will step in and identify probationary status. And then that becomes a burden on state government to do that work, very expensive. They will turn around and leverage fees to pay for all of that on the locals. And so the local entities themselves will lose the authority and the momentum. And then they will, of course, be out an enormous amount of money. And it could be a very difficult thing to try to reassert authority at a local level. So we really want to see these folks go ahead and make their decisions and get going on their planning. And then, of course, we need to provide the incentives to help this happen. The department has proposed some facilitation services. There is a funding mechanism in Prop 1. We do need to try to get that money out and at least a first deposit, and those services need to be available before 2016, because that's when we need to actually start spending money and making decisions. And then, of course, we need to start spending money now. And then rapidly identifying or removing any administrative barriers that might be out there. There is one thing that we're working with the department on and trying to put notice out to the entities, and that is the CASGEM program, which was sort of a down payment on monitoring. And there are some entities that have not yet fully complied with the CASGEM program. That could be a barrier to them receiving additional funding and could be a speed bump that we need to try to remove as rapidly as possible. And then I think all of our roles, again, as AQUA, as well as the department and all the other entities that are working on this, need to highlight successful approaches as we hear about them. There's all kinds of folks that are out there to help that are having all kinds of programs and conferences, and we want to highlight the models that seem to be working so that folks can, in other areas maybe that are being that are having a little bit harder time getting out of the starting block, they can look to those models and maybe just immediately start adopting some of the approaches that they're seeing as successes. And so that concludes my presentation. I appreciate your indulgence.
Great. Thank you very much, Dave. It was an excellent presentation, and you hit on a question that I had immediately, which was what's actually happening, and that was helpful to get those case studies of what is going forth in certain areas. Questions from any commissioners? Commissioner Orth?
Maybe not a question, but a comment. And Dave Gutierrez, you may want to speak to this as well. As I recall, the Act is pretty descriptive and definitive of the roles of the Department and the Commission as it relates to basin boundary adjustments and the GSP regulations. But as Dave Boland points out, the interrelationship between GSA formation and boundaries is pretty critical.
and even furthermore in some of this GSA planning effort that's underway, and the examples, and those are being repeated dozens and dozens of places over and over from different perspectives, some clarity in the GSA formation process might be appropriate early. And, you know, when I think about the, when I look at the slide, Dave Boland, that you had where, you know, there are conceptual models, I think it's important to answer the question whether or not those are models that absolutely have to be in place by June of 17 or whether or not those are models that can be in evaluation as the plan is then ultimately developed. Because an argument can be made that governance might look a whole lot different after the plan is adopted than it would when you initially form your GSA group to create the plan. And I don't know if the department intends to speak to that, and Dave, whether or not those are, Dave Gutierrez, whether those are things that you'd like to respond to.
Okay, so those are definitely some difficult questions. First of all, development of groundwater sustainability agencies and the department's role in those developments. So the way we kind of look at the law, the department has very little authority or responsibility in how those GSAs get established. Now, we do have the authority to actually post the information, and we're doing that, and I think that's up and running already. However, we do obviously have interests in those GSAs getting established, and they have to get established early on. And I think Dave pointed out accurately the fact that basin boundaries and groundwater sustainability agencies and actually groundwater sustainability plans are all going to go kind of hand in hand, which is kind of why we've developed the process that we've developed. So in other words, the groundwater sustainability agencies, they won't really know the rules of the game until the actual regulations of basin boundaries are completed, which is the end of the year. However, if those agencies get an understanding of the direction that we're taking this, that I think will help them kind of foresee the future, which is why we're trying to do like a guiding principles approach. We're going to give some principles to get some buy-in on the direction that we're kind of going. And that doesn't give you a guarantee that the regulations are going to be written in a particular way, but at least we'll be able to get those kind of discussions on the table and get some direction on where the regulations are headed. Some of the things I think we may be able to, the way the law is written right now, and our authorities on groundwater sustainability agencies and things like overlap, et cetera, if the law continues the way it is and there's no changes, some of those things I believe can get taken into consideration when we start developing things like groundwater sustainability plans, et cetera. So I think those can be taken care of that. That way, I think we can start developing guiding principles to outline some of those kind of bumps in the road. And I think the question is, who really has the authority over who's really the groundwater sustainability agency? That's a pretty difficult question to answer. I don't necessarily have the answer to that, but we've been struggling with that ourselves.
I've got one quick question, and maybe Commissioners Worth and Cirino may even know the answer. Clarification purposes, in the statute, can private entities participate as members of the GSA? My understanding is they could not.
No, they cannot.
Okay. But I assume, obviously, they're going to be involved in all that. And, right.
There are a lot of ways in which they can be involved in, and there are a lot of different models of governance that incorporate an opportunity for representation and response to their issues and needs.
Yeah, and the reason why I asked is just you mentioned that association composed of a variety of different public and private interests and them potentially serving as a GSA, and I was just wondering how that might work.
And I think the key word you said is participate. A better way to say it is they cannot become a groundwater sustainability agency if they're not a public agency. But there are avenues to participate in the entire process, and that's also outlined a little bit in the law.
Great. Any questions? Okay, well, thank you very much. It's a monumental task that you have, and we understand that, so appreciate it. Okay, moving on to item number 11 on the agenda, which I prematurely called earlier, which is the update on the program and administrative activities of a water storage investment program. And welcome, Jenny, new member of the commission staff. Okay, moving on to item number 11 on the agenda, which I prematurely called earlier, which is the update on the program and administrative activities of a water storage investment program. And welcome, Jenny, new member of the commission staff.
Thank you. Good morning, members of the commission. I'd just like to first off say how excited I am and looking forward I am to working with all of you in developing and implementing this program as a member of your staff. So there's three things I'd like to talk about under this agenda item, one being the draft goals, objectives, and principles document, another being a draft process flowchart that is an initial framework in how the application development and review process could go, and then lastly, the scoping survey results, which I know everyone's waiting for, and this is just a teaser right now because this will be the third thing I get to. So the goals, objectives, and principles document. Last month, we presented an initial staff draft. We collected some comments from various commission members over the last month. We did not receive any public or stakeholder comments, and we reflected all the comments received in red line strikeout. So the version that you have is the updated version with commissioner comments. I'd like to just briefly walk through what those comments were and what pages they are reflected on, and then I'd ask for any discussion or acceptance of the red line strikeout. So on the vision statement, we updated the vision statement to provide a little bit of clarity on after March 2017 and before January 2022, the Water Commission will commit the $2.7 billion in Prop 1 funding. We also added a little bit of language that's closer to the introduction of Chapter 8 that we will fund qualified water storage projects that will provide public benefits, improve the operation of the state water system, are cost-effective, and provide measurable improvements to the Delta and or its TRIBs. So moving on to page 3, I did move all of the references to footnotes. In most cases, the references are just included in Chapter 1 as reference material of where we are setting the stage for how water storage is used in California. There are places where we can remove the references if the commission decides to adopt the language that's written. And then I think we can move on to the goals and objectives on page 7. We added two new goals based on comments received at the last meeting, one being to increase local and regional water supply reliability, in other words, self-reliance, thereby reducing reliance on water supplies conveyed through the Delta. And another program goal for promoting and providing incentives for integrated multi-benefit projects, and that seemed to be a theme of the last meeting. Then on the final page, page 9, we added a new principle, and that was based on a comment to add a principle on sustainable groundwater management, and this language was taken from the findings of Proposition 1. So with that, that was kind of a quick overview. Are there any comments you'd like to make on the changes that were made? I think at this point, our plan is to keep this as a draft for at least another cycle of commission meetings to allow the new commission members to provide comments. And we're embarking on our stakeholder advisory committee and public meeting process. So just to allow some time to let this ebb and flow a little bit.
Questions, any commissioners? Comments, edits? I thought it looked very good, Jenny. The changes were good. The only thought I would have is on page 7 when it talks about initiating the stakeholder process, if it's still a living document, I would just appropriately update the date or indicate that we have established it. Yeah.
Great.
Commissioner Sarcia.
I'm sorry, can I ask what the process is for ultimately finalizing this and when we will? Because I may have some comments on the changes here.
That's a good question. What are your thoughts, Rachel?
That would be entirely up to the commission. As Jenny said, the commission may wish to wait until the stakeholder process has been initiated, and we have a little bit more public input, but certainly I think it would be appropriate to adopt these before the end of the summer.
So when is the first stakeholder group meeting, or when do you think you'll have?
The first stakeholder group meeting is April 1st, and the first series of public meetings is mid-April. And I'll have the specific dates when we talk about the next agenda item.
So perhaps the May meeting would be an appropriate time frame to finalize this?
Does that sound, Commissioner Saracino? And process-wise, I assume it can be distributed to, it's been distributed to us, and any edits prior to that time, with enough time for us to view and comment prior to the May meeting.
Yeah, I think so. And just for the record, my concern, outstanding concern, is the issue about whether reversing groundwater overdraft in and of itself is going to constitute a public benefit. And I know what Prop 1 language says, but I also know that there are specifically defined public benefits as part of the storage programs. And this may be a legal question that we need to get into in terms of determining whether how we're going to sort that out if an applicant proposes, for example, just to do groundwater recharge. Does that applicant have to describe the ultimate use of that water and where the public benefit actually accrues, or is just reducing groundwater overdraft in and of itself a public benefit sufficient for our findings? And I'm not sure it is, but I'd like to get some kind of...
Yeah, I think we can look at that more closely, but my initial take on it is that it would have to be have some close relationship to a water storage project. In other words, it might be an attendant benefit of a particular water storage project.
But a water storage project that provides public benefits as described in the chapter.
Exactly.
Right? But and this language does not really say that.
No,
so,
this doesn't.
Yeah, I would like to revisit that language.
Can I, great point. Yeah, Commissioner Curtin.
I was thinking about this a little bit. And exactly what is a public benefit for groundwater storage recharge? In conjunction with the last presentation, and the usage of the water is critical, but if the water is restricted from usage to a certain degree to protect the sustainability of the mm-hmm. groundwater, that's the only sort of process that I was thinking through, so that you just don't put it in and take it out whenever you feel like it and send it wherever you want, that part of the public benefit of groundwater might be establishing what a sustainability level is, and as you're raising the groundwater, the sustainability level of that.
Well, again, I think you have to describe what you're sustaining it for. If you're sustaining it such that some of that water supply can go to the public benefits like ecosystem improvement, then I'd agree with you. If an area is sustaining that groundwater supply simply so they can pump it out and use it to grow grapes, which is a beneficiary issue, it's not really a public benefit. So I think there needs to be a clear distinction.
And I agree with you, but my question is there a level of water in these groundwater areas that is the sustainable level?
Yes.
And that might be the public benefit associated with it. I don't know. It's not that it can go anywhere. This is the water that we're putting in here, and we can't take it out for anything but ecosystem purposes. Beyond that, anything above that sustainability level, yes, and that would be not a public benefit. So that's a good question.
Yeah, I think these are the questions we need to get to for the benefit of project applicants in particular.
Commissioner Orth, and then, I'm sorry, Commissioner Bosca, and then Commissioner Orth.
Isn't there a requirement that that the objective is to provide measurable ecosystem improvements to the Delta and its tributaries? I think that it has. I think somehow doesn't it have to clear that hurdle first.
It does. Yeah.
That's correct. It does. And there's also a special treatment for ecosystem benefits that they have to be at least 50% ecosystem benefits for a particular project to get the funding from the bond fund.
Yeah, 50% of the funds we provide need to go towards the ecosystem. Commissioner Orth.
I certainly understand and recognize that maybe that last new bullet under program principles needs some tweaking, although I'd be interested in if in fact this is a statement of out of Prop 1, you know, that we make it in the right context, but we not exclude it because we're concerned about. I just don't think we need to exclude it. My interest in this last month was really more focused on the Sustainable Groundwater Management Act, which requires now state agencies in the adoption of regulations and other actions to consider how those impact sustainable groundwater management objectives. And so I think as I looked at this last month and expressed some interest, I think our program principals need to recognize within the constraints of Chapter 8 of Prop 1 that there is a linkage to sustainable groundwater management as part of this. There's a duty for us to consider in the adoption of these regs in this program how they affect sustainable groundwater management objectives under that act.
Yeah, I certainly agree with that. I think my point is that in and of itself is not sufficient for us to fund a project on the basis of public benefits.
And I would agree to that.
Yeah, well, maybe we can work on the language, because it seems to me the reference to public benefit at the end is maybe what is making you a little more uncomfortable, Anthony, which I agree with you. It kind of implies that we're potentially classifying it as a public benefit when it needs to meet all the other criteria that are laid out.
I think the distinction is it is an extraordinary public benefit from the standpoint that you could sustain an entity to continue to grow crops. That provides a public benefit, but it's not a public benefit as defined in the storage section that we have to find in order to fund projects.
It's almost an independently defined by statute public benefit,
right,
just by virtue of it being said as a public benefit in the statute, not according to the Chapter 8.
Right, but I don't think that public benefit is sufficient for us to make a finding, and that's what I'd like to get counsel's opinion on.
Okay, I think that's a great point, and I can work with counsel and Jenny, and we can potentially have an edit on that language to come back at the next meeting or when appropriate.
Yep.
When we're. Any other further questions? Okay.
Okay. So I will move on then to the next item in your packet, which is a draft process flowchart. So this was put together as a new member of the team to try to wrap my head around how does the technical analysis and the review process and application development process, how does it all fit together? And what are considerations that we need to make throughout the process? And we wanted to wait to add a lot of detail to this until we received feedback from the commission and received feedback from the scoping survey. So over the next couple months, we'll be adding detail and timing to this process flowchart. But just walking through it, one of the things I wanted to point out are the color blocks in it. These are kind of points in time on our process where DWR, the commission, could interact with potential applicants. And last month, we heard from Professor Lund that the commission should be cold and calculating when making its decisions. But these color blocks give us points in time to be warm and caring and provide some opportunity for interaction between the commission, DWR technical staff, and the potential applicants. And you'll see when I go through the scoping survey, there's a lot of education and technical assistance that's going to need to be provided throughout this process to make sure the applicants are able to put their best foot forward and be able to present projects that are eligible and consistent with the legislation. So just walking through this rather quickly, the first two boxes really deal with operations. The DWR develops common without project conditions, and the applicant must use those conditions when doing their project operations analysis. And we really thought that was important to allow projects to be analyzed on an equal footing. So when projects come in, they're using the same year of analysis, they're using common hydraulic conditions, and we really wanted to make sure that we're comparing apples to apples when we get projects in.
The next larger box and the two boxes below it are kind of consistent but different pathways to do economics. Our current proposal is that DWR develops recommended economic analysis methodology and unit values, and those will be provided to applicants well ahead of the application development process to do their economic analysis, but we're not saying they must use the recommended economic analysis. The two boxes below say that they can develop their own methodology or values for economic analysis, but they have to provide justification for why they use those unit value or why they use those economic values or the methodology that they're using. So we're providing some opening for different methodologies to be used, but DWR does plan to update the method and tools document to provide the recommended approach and potential other approaches that could be considered. So the next box, when it merges together, the applicant conducts economic analysis, including a least cost alternative. Right now, we're using least cost alternative to be the metric for projects are cost effective. We're not asking applicants at this point to do a benefit cost ratio. The next box includes a lot of different things. It's one box that has applicant completing all application requirements and providing documentation as requested from the PSP. That can include a whole host of things, including feasibility analyses on constructability, operations, financial feasibility, economic feasibility, environmental feasibility, including analysis that indicates how applicants are addressing the priorities of the Water Board and Department of Fish and Wildlife, and also the analysis that we're going to ask applicants to do on indicating how their project provides delta improvements. So that includes a lot of different analysis in one box, and you'll see this get expanded over time in how we're going to implement the program. And during this time, right now we're proposing that DWR staff, technical staff, be available for questions, do technical assistance and workshops across the state. We also are proposing that a member of the Water Commission staff be available as a caseworker, per se, for various applicants to call and do an early checklist of, this is what I plan to include in my application. Is it considered complete? Do I have all the required components? So the blue box indicates a potential level of being warm and caring and providing technical assistance while applicants are doing the difficult work of analyzing, formulating, and documenting their projects. So going down to the second swim lane, once the applicants submit applications to the Water Commission, we will have an agency team conduct a completeness and eligibility review. So that's basically just a checklist. Do they have everything that we asked for, and is the project eligible? One of the decisions, at a future point, but not necessarily today, we will ask the commission is if a project is determined to be incomplete or ineligible, would we allow for the process to reach out to the applicant and allow them to remedy what they might be missing or reformulate the project with potentially a time frame in mind that if they're missing some part of the application, they can have a month to provide it. So once we get the applications and do the completeness and eligibility review, the agency team will conduct a first level technical review of the data that was provided. And the agency team includes Water Commission staff, DWR staff, staff from Department of Fish and Wildlife, staff from State Board, and staff from Delta Stewardship Council. That's currently what our agency team is made up of. We're going to include a reasonableness assessment, still to be determined how that'll be applied, but that's for applicants that use a different economic analysis methodology or values that will have the agency team review if that if they consider that method to be reasonable. Next, we're suggesting that DWR perform an integration study on the projects that are included. You know, we are asking, as part of the improved operations of the state water system, that applicants come forward with an integration study of how their project might integrate with the current system. But what we are suggesting is to take that further as a review team and look at how the projects that were submitted might integrate together and work together. So we're not just ranking projects individually or scoring or whatever, however we might evaluate these projects, and have certain projects rise to the highest level or highest tier, or identify as better projects. And these are projects that are benefiting the same groups, competing for the same water, and you know, might just be in conflict with each other. So we want to do a next level of screening where we can evaluate how certain projects might provide collectively better benefits. Then we'll convene an independent review panel that will review the technical review of the agency team and the integration study. That panel will write its recommendations and findings and evaluation in a format that's consistent for all the projects to be provided to the members of the commission, so the commission has the information they need to make their findings. But that's our kind of framework that we're operating to right now. We've got some draft timelines associated with how long each of these steps in the process could happen. I think Tracy Billington's going to talk a little bit about that this afternoon during the issues workshop, but we really wanted to present the initial framework, get the results of the scoping survey, and really add detail over the next couple months to this.
Okay. Any questions, Commissioner Ball?
The independent review panel, how is that chosen, assembled, appointed? Who has authority for that?
It's still something we're considering, and we'll bring a proposal forth to the commission, and you know, that we intend at this point would be open to nationally recognized experts in a few key areas of water policy, environmental, economics. We've got a list of potential areas that this independent review panel could be made up of, but that's still to be determined.
And who's going to determine that?
The commission.
Okay. So that's us. We appoint it. We determine it. That's okay. All right.
And it could be, you know, folks that are under contract as well, you know, as part of that. It's up to us to figure out.
Territory, right?
Yeah.
Just an idea.
Sure. Commissioner Saraceno.
This is a very good description of the process. Thanks for doing that. However, when you start thinking about the details of each of these boxes and what's going to be required, it becomes mind-numbingly incredibly difficult. And so I just want to focus on one area for now. The DWR performs preliminary integration study on projects. And you may not know this. Perhaps someone from DWR can answer how they plan to do that, or is there a description of what is expected to come out of that? Because there are so many possible iterations of combinations of projects and what the conclusions would be that feed the independent review panel. I think we need to think very carefully about what kind of integration studies are done such that there can be something meaningful that comes out for the review panel to look at.
Definitely. Yeah. We're still scoping most of the steps of this flowchart out and what that integration study might look like and what tools we may use to conduct that study. There are tools that are out there that allow people to make decisions based on various criteria. So we could, that integration study could be something where we're using more of, I don't want to say generic, but there are decision-making tools where you can apply weights to certain scoring and allow things to ebb and flow based on what priority you put to certain benefit categories or certain outcomes, or we could take this to a level where it's, you know, we're using very technical tools like CalSim and groundwater models to actually get data on how these projects might integrate. So that's something that's still to be determined, but you know, over the next couple of months, we'll be providing detail and potential proposals for all of these steps along the way for the commission to make decisions on.
Yeah, and I think one of the difficult policy decisions we're going to have to make is that an applicant, for example, may not propose a particular integration with another existing project or another proposed project. But if DWR does an integration study that demonstrates clear benefits in doing so, do we then only fund that project if by requiring them to integrate, or if they're still a viable project as a standalone project, are they fundable? There are going to be a number of these tough policy decisions that we'll have to decide upon. So I think the sooner we can articulate what that would look like, the better.
I think that's a great point. And what I was just thinking when you were asking the question is, what, if any, will we decide it's our ability to further condition projects as we award them and figure out how they fit in better? Because one of the requirements in the Act is the fact that they have to have contracts in place with not just, and I guess that was something to fill in here too, at what point are we going to require that? I know the requirement is that before we fund, they have to have contracts in place with all the participating agencies as well as Fish and Wildlife and State Water Resources Control Board. I assume those contracts would be, a lot of them would relate to the public benefits and the potential overall benefits to the water system. So, but I agree with what Danny's about to say, which is we need to have the ability to be flexible.
Absolutely, we should be prepared to condition approvals on the basis of integration. That's fundamentally what we're here for. I just want to make sure that the federal project is part of this integration discussion. I don't know what the laws are regarding what we can mandate or not mandate, but my assumption is we're going to try to do more integration with the federal and state project rather than less. So I notice it's just DWR, but there should be a consultative process here, at least with the federal projects.
Definitely.
And, yeah, I think it would be remiss of us not to be able to say, look, we love your project, but we're looking for more integration. And here's some suggestions, or come back with another thought on this. And it's all going to be in a fairly compact time framework. So what I'm hoping is the people who propose projects have these thoughts in their mind while they're developing these project proposals, so that it doesn't come as a surprise that we turn around and say, you know what, it's a great project, but it doesn't really integrate all that well. So go back and take another look at it. The more upfront we can be about it, the better.
And I assume, Jenny, going to be asking them to do integration studies themselves as part of the application? I mean, maybe the role for DWR is to evaluate their study and then, of course, build upon it.
Yeah, one of the eligibility requirements is that the projects improve the state water system, and currently we're defining that as SWP and CVP. So they would have to do integration studies with at least the major systems in the state.
Got it. Any additional questions? Great. And this is a very helpful chart. Usually I have a hard time following charts, but this one I understand.
Good. I'm glad. I was not sure if this should be shared, but Rachel said it was helpful to her, and she thought it would be helpful to you all. So thank you.
That's great.
Very good. Okay. So without further ado, the scoping survey. So we conducted a scoping survey really for education purposes. This wasn't to develop a project list of potential applicants or potential projects. It was just to determine the level of interest from potential applicants and what their understanding is of the legislation and the process for funding water storage projects that the commission is embarking on. And it was kind of a two-way education that we really wanted to get this out there to really identify for them what our eligibility requirements are and do their projects fulfill those eligibility requirements. And on the flip side, you know, for us to learn, you know, where project proponents and potential applicants are at. So we released this survey on February 24th. It was sent to the Water Commission's listserv and the listservs and other organization leads of 22 organizations. So it had pretty wide distribution. I'm sure there are some people that received the survey 15 plus times. But with that said, we were really surprised by our response. It was a very positive response to the survey. But I'm going to keep you waiting a few more minutes. Our preliminary findings on the survey was stakeholders and potential applicants need more information. We just haven't really gotten out there with our stakeholder engagement and communication process yet. We're just embarking on this. This was our first step in that process, and it kind of established that baseline for where stakeholders and potential applicants are at and what they know about the program. It really stressed that technical and program assistance will be critical. A lot of information is needed to be put out there, and a lot of education is going to happen throughout this whole process to make sure that applicants get the information that they need. And another major finding of this was that the majority of projects are on a similar time frame. There's not a whole lot of projects that have checked all their boxes and are ready to be funded today. It actually looks like the preliminary schedule that we've developed for this program and when the majority of projects will be ready coincide very nicely. That most of the projects are looking at completing their feasibility studies and environmental documentation really between 2 to 4 years from now. So without further ado, the results. So as of March 11th, when we did a snapshot of the survey results, we had 162 responses. So as many surveys as I've been involved in as state agency, this is probably one that had the most attention. 162 is probably about four times as much as any response I've seen in a survey in the past.
3 weeks, that's a 3 week response time.
Yeah, and after 2 weeks, we had 50 responses. So 100 plus came in the last week that we had the survey open. And 15 of those responses, when we were going through and developing our statistics, we eliminated because, some of them were just trying to progress through the survey to see what the next question was. So there'd be a one-letter answer or just a test word in the block. So we eliminated those responses for our survey. And we eliminated duplicate responses. There was a few cases, 7, that project proponents or potential applicants from various agencies submitted on the same project. So we went through those responses and deleted the duplicates. So all in all, the survey results and statistics you'll see are based on 147 responses. We didn't do much more screening at that point, but I will point out that many of the remaining responses at this point, without some further education to these potential agencies, were not technically eligible for our program. There was many plans that were asking for funding or responding to the survey, a few desalination projects, and a few research and development projects. So the 147 at this point represent projects that had information, and really our high criteria was a contact person and an agency name. So we'll show some further drilling down into the responses in some of the later slides. So the agency types represented, we had 100% response to agency type, and all of the eligible agency types were represented. And this was a checkbox, so you had to select one of these. So at this point it looks like everyone who applied is an eligible applicant under our criteria. With 80% at this point being public agencies, but we do have some responses from public utilities, tribes, nonprofits, and mutual water companies. The project types that were represented, 84% of the survey respondents answered this question, with the majority being groundwater storage and remediation at 50%. But this was the category that tended to see the most ineligible project types, or what appeared to be ineligible project types, that they were planning projects, they were research and development projects, and a lot of them were planning for the Groundwater Sustainability Act. So I think when we drill down a little bit, the numbers decreased a little bit for groundwater storage and regional and local ground or surface storage projects tended to bump up. So project timelines, 69% of the respondents answered the question dealing with when do you think your feasibility studies will be complete? And 54% of respondents answered the question, when do you think your environmental documentation will be complete? So this is a large hurdle for any of these projects to attain, but 85% of projects said that they would have their feasibility studies complete within 5 years, and 95% of the projects that answered this question indicated that their environmental documentation would be done within 5 years. So public benefits. 76% of the respondents checked a box on public benefits. This was another checkbox answer. Will your project potentially provide this list of benefits? I think that was the most interesting answer to this is only 57% of the projects that answered this question provided ecosystem improvements. This needs to be 100%. Mm-hmm. So that's part of the education that we need to work with the potential applicants and project proponents to help them either just educate them on what the requirements of the legislation are or help them determine ways to reformulate their project to provide ecosystem improvements. But all of the other public benefit categories were represented. A further additional consideration for project eligibility is demonstrating measurable improvements to the Delta ecosystem or to tributaries of the Delta. And 23 respondents answered this question, and only 23% of projects provided or checked this box, that they said their project provides measurable improvements to the Delta ecosystem or TRIBS. So this is another point where we're going to have to work with stakeholders, work with the public, work with project proponents to get this response up to 100. Because this is another eligibility requirement for the program. So getting into project costs. 67% of projects provided a cost. So this does not represent a total number for all the projects that are out there. This is just a majority of the projects that responded. So if we look at a total project cost for all the projects, it was about $13 billion. A maximum possible cost share, if we said we're going to fund 50% of all of these, is $6 billion. So I think this just goes to illustrate just statewide what a need there is for water storage and the bond just being a down payment on addressing a lot of the needs that are out there. And I drilled down a little bit into the project costs and looked at specifically what were the project costs for projects that identified that, yes, I have a project with ecosystem improvements. And the number didn't decrease that much. It's still, you know, almost $12 billion in total project cost.
Can I ask about that? Sorry, just that's curious because the response for ecosystem improvements was only about 67% answered that they provided ecosystem improvements, and yet it accounts for 90-plus percent. Huh, so that's very interesting.
To be frank, a lot of the bigger projects are able to check the ecosystem improvement box and the Delta improvement box, and they account for a large portion of project cost. So total project costs that are able to provide ecosystem improvements and Delta improvements, still project costs, you know, only come down about 25%, that it's still almost $10 billion in project costs for those projects, which would, if we took the full 50% of our cost share, is $5 billion. So over almost twice what is available from Prop 1. The by project type, and again, only 67% of projects provide at cost. All the CalFed surface storage projects that were included in the survey provide at cost. So where you're looking at 100% of the potential CalFed surface storage project costs, but a lesser percent of the other ones. So it looks like a rather large number compared to everything else at this point, but they did have 100% response to this. So 54% of the total project costs were from the CalFed surface storage projects, 20% from local and regional surface storage, almost 20% from groundwater storage, and about 7% from reoperation and conjunctive use.
And Jenny, did Shasta respond as well?
No, they did not.
Okay.
I just don't remember.
Commissioner Boskin.
Yeah, I was going to ask this question, and maybe I could have waited till the end, but are some of the proposals, could they find funding in some of the other chapters? Can you see that? I don't know if you did an analysis of that.
I did not do an analysis of that, but it seems for groundwater, I don't believe there's funding for projects. It's planning. So they would turn to this chapter to look for funding. I believe there's some ecosystem funding available, so they could potentially get funding from multiple chapters, projects that provide those benefits. But I'm not sure on other benefit categories.
Wouldn't there is some integrated regional water management planning funding that would typically fund some of these smaller local facilities, I think.
I think there is some funding.
I think it could, yeah.
I'm just not sure at this point if it's planning
Billington.
Or
yes!
If there's planning or project funding.
So there is implementation funding for IRWM funding, so some of these projects could be funded under that. It's not a lot, and so the large facilities, probably not. There is $800 million for groundwater contamination and remediation in the bond, so that is another area where some of the funding could come and possibly help those types of projects. But those for the storage, this is the program.
So,
thank you, Trace. Commissioner,
I was just going to ask. We don't have authority over the non-storage portion of the funding, but we could certainly recommend cooperation with the Department of Water Resources in certain fashion to make these things work a little bit more integrated. So that's something we need to keep in mind.
That's a good point.
So going just back to recapping our findings, really the biggest takeaway from the survey for us was more education and information is needed to be put out there. We need to get the ecosystem improvements public benefit to 100% response. We have to get the delta improvements to 100% response. We think it's important that project applicants get support during the application development process to determine project eligibility. There's some education that has to happen there. And again, just for project readiness, it seemed like most of the projects that were responding to the survey, their schedule coincided nicely with this program schedule, that we're not holding up projects that are, you know, waiting for funding. And then next steps. So this survey was very informative, and so we don't want to close it. We want to, at least at this point, we don't want to close it. We want to keep it open through the spring and to allow additional project applicants or potential project applicants to fill out the survey with their project information. Allow applicants that did respond or potential applicants that did respond to update their information that they provided. Just as we embark on our outreach process, You know, we want to make sure that we're always presenting the best and latest information, so we want to leave this survey open for potential updates. You know, and we'll use this scoping survey, the results that we received, to inform the project solicitation timeline and various funding scenarios, and allow you to make decisions, and we'll make proposals based on when it seemed that projects were going to be ready for funding and how you might structure projects or project solicitation packages or guidelines, if it was going to be all in one slug or in several slugs based on types of projects or whatever it might be. But we can use the results of this survey to inform the future development of the program. So that's it on the survey. I'm happy to answer any questions or allow time for discussion.
Questions from any commissioners? No, Jenny? I thought that was excellent. I think it looks like going back to your grid, so along the way you'll be bringing to us for consideration the variety of issues that, I mean...
Yeah, and one of the things that we're setting up for this commission meeting and future commission meetings are what we're calling issue workshops.
Yeah.
So that's what we'll have after lunch, where we'll be bringing forward the top three, top five issues of the day that we'd like discussion and decisions on in order to move forward in the development of the program and the regulations.
Okay, that sounds great. Thank you very much, Jenny. Appreciate it. Okay, brings us to the legislative. If Casey is here, if not, we can do that after lunch, I guess, and break earlier. Huh? He's not here. What's the pleasure of the commission? Do we want to take break early, come back early, and have...
How long is the next section going to take?
So there's actually a couple other items. Jenny is presenting another item.
Oh.
And then we also have
I'm sorry, Jenny.
Anicita Agustinas, who is going to be presenting on tribal consultation.
I appreciate it. I'm sorry. I was thinking with my stomach.
And I'm happy to talk fast so everyone can get to lunch a little sooner. So this agenda
no pressure item, whatsoever. Yeah. There is none.
If I talk too fast, slow me down. This agenda item is on the stakeholder engagement process. So currently, the project team has developed a draft communication and engagement plan. I provided a outline of that plan in your packet. I'm just going to go over a couple of the key sections of that. So the purpose of our communication and engagement plan is to guide the commission's engagement with agencies, stakeholders, and the public as it develops the guidelines and regulations, guidelines, regulations, and criteria for the eventual allocation of $2.7 billion of investments in water storage projects. We really have two facets to the communication and engagement plan. Similar to what Dave said about the groundwater sustainability program, you know, communication is really education and information, project status update, and that engagement is the interaction and feedback from stakeholders and the public. And really, our program is focused around engagement. You know, we want as much input into this process as possible. As much input and buy-in as we can get early on, it makes the regulations easier to go through the formal rulemaking process, and it'll improve the quality of the projects that are submitted when we're asking for applications. So the intended outcomes of our C&E plan is to provide a high level of visibility among key stakeholders about the opportunity to learn about and comment on the water storage investment programs. Another intended outcome, to have representation from each targeted stakeholder organization in all public engagement activities. Another common understanding among stakeholder organizations about the criteria for eligible projects aim to avoid submissions of ineligible projects to the commission for funding by the Water Storage Investment Program. And lastly, an intended outcome is public support for the guidelines, regulations, and criteria, and to develop a program that far exceeds any opposition. So part of our C&E plan is development of the key stakeholder constituencies and our stakeholder advisory committee. The stakeholder advisory committee was developed to represent the following interests. First, we looked at key stakeholders that could represent the project types that are eligible within the legislation. So the CalFed surface storage projects, groundwater storage, contamination prevention or remediation projects, conjunctive use projects, reservoir re-op projects, and local or regional surface storage projects that improve the operation of the water systems in the state and provide public benefits. Further, we wanted to find key stakeholders that represented the public benefit categories. So stakeholders that represented ecosystem improvements, water quality, flood control, emergency response, and recreation. Beyond that, there were special considerations that we wanted to add to the stakeholder representation, and that was tribal representation, business and economic representation, and environmental justice and disadvantaged communities representation. When selecting our stakeholder advisory committee, we really wanted to keep the group as small as possible, but have broad representation. So we targeted about 30 stakeholder advisory committee members to keep it manageable, but to make sure that within those 30 members, there was broad representation across the categories that I just mentioned. And we put favor towards 8 associations and caucuses that represented a broader stakeholder group. So there's a measles chart of the agencies that were invited to the stakeholder advisory committee. It's a checkbox chart. There's 30 agencies on this list. We sent out invitations in early March and gave agencies till March 20th to respond, either with a yes, I'll accept, or no, I cannot participate. 14 agencies have so far accepted the invitation. And, you know, we do have a process for if an agency organization does not feel that they're represented by any of the organizations that were invited, we have a process for adding potential members to the group, but we ask that a written request be sent to the executive officer, and the executive officer will work with them to determine if their organization's views are already represented on the stakeholder committee, or if it's a view or point of interest that is not represented, and if that is the case, they will be invited to join the stakeholder advisory committee.
And I'll add here, I think it's the stakeholder group is not going to be making any decisions or voting or anything. It's simply advisory. I think staff's done a very good job of selecting the representation. It may be that there's some altering that is done as maybe people come forward or not. But all of the meetings are going to be open to the public.
Yes.
And there will be opportunities for everybody to participate. So it's not this big exclusive group that's going to have private meetings or anything like that. So I think the effort that's been done is a good one. And I'm sure, like I said, we will probably get some input here or there. But that is my understanding of it, and I've got a good level of comfort with it. But I just wanted to say that.
Yep. Thank you.
Commissioner Kerr.
So we've actually had, before you got here, the public comment period, 2 requests to be invited into the stakeholder meeting. And I think what you just outlined is a formal process where a letter to the executive officer would start that process. So for those who raised the issue, who still may be in the audience, you know, we heard you. I know there was 2, but just send in a letter and let's cogitate about it.
And lastly, great. I'd like to draw the commission's attention to the 11 by 17, or it should be an 11 by 17 color chart for folks that aren't involved in the stakeholder process and other stakeholders in the public. There will be plenty of opportunities to participate in this process. Not only are the stakeholder advisory committee meetings open to the public, and they will be noticed 10 days in advance of when the meetings will occur, we have established a kind of steady rhythm to when those meetings will occur, so everyone knows that the first Wednesday of every month will be a stakeholder advisory committee meeting in Sacramento. So the red boxes at the top identify the dates of all the stakeholder advisory committees and the topics that will be addressed at those committee meetings. And at various points in the committee meetings, we will invite, you know, technical experts to expand upon different topics and provide information to the stakeholder group. I've also put on here in green all of the commission meetings, and it was indicated at the last commission meeting that having commission meetings in other locations would be important to the commission members, and so we've identified potential alternate locations for commission meetings through October. We're kind of on an alternating schedule of being in Sacramento and then traveling to another location. The only two that are set in stone at this point, of course, is today's meeting and next month's meeting in Fresno. So in May, we have the meeting back in Sacramento, in June in San Jose, July Sacramento, August Los Angeles, in September Sacramento. So the commission meetings themselves provide another opportunity for wide-reaching public input. As part of the commission meetings, we're including issue working sessions. So you'll have your first one this afternoon where we're diving a little bit deeper into the top issues of the month. In April, or I'll mention in May and June, we're also going to include some meeting workshops that will request a little bit more public involvement. So similar to the issue working session, but it would be, you know, we would request broader participation from the public, and we'd be focusing on very specific, mostly technical evaluation process type conversations, like the evaluation criteria, quantification of public benefits, and our project evaluation methodology. We've identified two series of public meetings that we'll do. Starting in April, we'll do a three-series public meeting, one in Fresno in conjunction with the commission meeting. So we'll have the commission meeting, and then in the evening, the public meeting. We'll have an April 13th meeting in Chico and a April 21st meeting in either Walnut Creek or Concord. And then in July, August timeframe, we'll do another series of kind of statewide public meetings. I'll let Anacita talk about the tribal consultation workshop in June, but I would like to just mention that for any of the stakeholder meetings and the public meetings, the participation of the commission members would be greatly appreciated. Any opportunity that you would have to participate and provide opening remarks would be welcome. And that's it for me.
Commissioner Curtin?
No, I missed that bottom row, which that sort of answered my concern. Chico, Contra Costa, Redding, Bakersfield, etc.
Although, how did we miss the Napa Valley? They have critical water issues there.
Yeah. We can always
add Paso Robles, right?
That's our next spring. We're going to do a month-long workshop.
And I would just like to add, in terms of participation of the commission members, we understand that you're all very busy and that this is quite an extensive meeting schedule, and we would be particularly interested in having
a couple commission members at the first meeting of the Stakeholder Advisory Committee in April, and also at the public meetings, it would be great to have one or two commission members who are maybe from the area where we're holding the meeting at these public evening workshops, but we certainly wouldn't expect the whole commission to attend.
I think that's a great idea. We'll, as those meetings approach, volunteers, please let Rachel know, and Rachel will reach out to all of us to request involvement if we're not jumping at it. But okay, thank you, Jen. Sorry, Casey, there's one more in front of you. I called you early. Okay, item number 13 on the agenda, which is the tribal government consultation process.
Thank you,
Estacio, welcome back.
Yes. Thank you, commissioners, and a welcome to our new Commissioner Herrera. We're excited to work with you. My name is Anacita Augustinus, and I'm the Department of Water Resources Tribal Policy Advisor. And I've had the pleasure of working closely with Sue Sims before she left, and we worked closely on the scoping survey. As the water Tribal Policy Advisor for Department of Water Resources, we want to provide our services and whatever advisory role we can do for the California Water Commission. As falling under California Natural Resources policy, I think in your packet you have the governor's B-1011 order, executive order for engagement of tribal consultation, as well as the California Natural Resources Agency tribal consultation policy. So the importance of the June 9th and 10th event as a tribal consultation and a workshop over a two-day event is important. And as Ms. Valente mentioned, having commissioners present not only at public workshops or at other listening sessions, however many appropriate commissioners can be present at the June 9th and 10th workshop is very important. We want to engage in a full formal government-to-government consultation. What we are doing for the June 9th and 10th event is having an interdepartmental approach to consultation. Not only will California Water Commission be present, State Water Resources Control Board, the Department of Fish and Wildlife, and Department of Water Resources. We're doing this as a joint consultation under the various chapters in the Prop 1 water bond because tribal governments have information and access through those various funding allocations, and it would be a great opportunity to work closely together and leverage our resources. So we're putting the agenda together. The dates are set. They'll be held at the Cal EPA building in Byron Scherer Auditorium on June 9th and June 10th. June 9th is the actual tribal consultation event where it is government to government. There we will definitely want to have, if there's a conflict on attending 9th or 10th, June 9th is the priority date because that is the government to government consultation date. The second date will be actually the workshops from our various departments dealing with the grant programs, whatever areas of development we'll have with our program packages. A lot of our, because we're doing it interdepartmental, some of our programs will only be in discussion stages or they may be in more developed along in terms of draft guidelines. So the government-to-government consultation will be important to have that outlined for tribes. So you'll hear more about that, and I'll keep working closely with Jenny and Rachel on that as we go forward and provide updates. Involvement in the stakeholder process and what we've done with that is I suggested some individuals representing some statewide tribal or governmental organizations. And the there are tribal governments in California recognize how stretched they are, as well as our state agencies. So they have, in anticipation of the need for consultations, have developed these tribal government organizations that encompass all the 111 federally recognized tribes. Southern California Tribal Chairs Association has been in operation over 30 years. They represent all the tribes in Southern California. There is also a Northern California Tribal Chairs Association representing approximately 19 tribes in Northern California. There is a current formation of the Central California Tribal Chairs of California. They're putting together their bylaws and they're putting together their board membership, and they will, if once that is a formal group. They will encompass over 54 tribes in the Central California region. There are other governments, tribal governments, that may not participate in Northern, Central, and Southern, and those organizations are also being contacted and outreached and also being able to participate in June 9th and 10th. So this is a great opportunity to work with these tribal governments. Two names have been advanced representing Northern and Southern California that have accepted to be on your stakeholder process. I'm working with the Central California Tribal Chairs to develop a their selection of who will represent their voices. And I think that's really where we're at with the tribal consultation update. I don't know if you have any questions for me, but I'm happy to answer them.
Questions, any commissioners?
Not so much a question. I noticed there was three projects that came from tribal entities, proposals.
Yes, what I've done in the past past 6 months as we've been developing the Prop 1 water bond and I've been outreaching to tribal governments, I've included the initial scoping survey once it was in a draft form at all the discussions I've had with tribal groups. We've tried to outreach that with our tribal listserv that we have here at Department of Water Resources, as well as included that information at every tribal drought consultation call that we have monthly with the tribes. I'm not particularly informed on which three tribal projects okay. those are, but we've been including that with all the various DW outreach we do.
Okay, great. And we'll make sure that we're represented well at the June 9th and 10th meeting.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much for the update. Appreciate it. Okay, we're going to go back in the agenda to the legislative update, which we skipped, which is item 9. Welcome, Casey. See where the target of one bill.
Yeah, we just have only one piece of legislation we're looking at this year. Just kidding. Good afternoon, because we just have hit the afternoon. I'm going to, here in a second, need Felipe's help. I waved him off. I told him I could do this. Where is it? I guess I can't do it by myself. I needed Felipe. I decided to get fancy and start using colors in my presentations, but that's about as fancy as it gets. However, Kamyar has convinced me he can teach me how to do a little moving or fading images on it. So we'll see some progress here. Just going to give you a quick update on what pieces of legislation we as the Department of Water Resources have seen introduced so far this year that we would be tracking, and we'll get to one that I'm sure will be of interest to the commission itself. But just giving you a quick list here of starting out a broad group that I just listed as groundwater and flood protection. Let me first say that on all of these pages, you'll see on the left hand of the bill number, the asterisk ones. Those are all spot bills. Some do such things as change the word that to the word which, that change the word an to the word the. Some just simply declare legislative intent to enact a statute that relates to a particular issue. This is not uncommon early on to do a placeholder piece of legislation. Perhaps there's additional negotiation on some language that they want to have before frightening anyone with an introduction of specific language. Perhaps just some general vetting that would like to be done ahead of time. So you'll see quite a few of these that we have listed as spot bills. But a couple key ones on here to start off with. In the second column, SB 13 by Senator Pavley. Right now, that is the technical cleanup bill relating to last year's Groundwater Sustainability Act legislation. They're looking at some of the truly technical fixes, errant cross-references to legislation. I know there's a number of discussions about, and you'll see a number of bills on this that have been introduced with the purpose of having a discussion about, are there additional changes that need to take place? Are there additional tweaks that should happen? To give some example, Senator Nielsen's bill, SB 173, which I have listed there in the second column, would change the definition of a de minimis extractor. The bill from last year says it's a residential user using no more than 2 acre feet of water per year. This is looking to expand that, I think, up to 10 acre feet per year. So some bills like that are looking at changes to the legislation, some that are just looking at truly technical fixes to that. But this is some of these. We're looking, obviously, SB 37, also by Senator Nielsen in the second column, relates to some flood projects and the timeline over which reimbursement can be made for certain flood protection work. So some examples of what we're looking at there. A little smaller group of bills, but a few broader subject matter, urban and regional water management, some relating to integrated regional water management, some relating to the urban water management plans and the timeline for when they're submitted. Again, quite a few of these have the asterisk of spot bill. So there's not a lot of significant language in some of these. The CEQA / water quality section, there are a number of bills relating to CEQA. There are actually some relating to in the infrastructure piece also, relating to what one or two proposals that would define what a water project under Proposition 1, what that is defined as, and then declaring a separate process for, I think, one of the bills would require the concurrent preparation of the record with a project from a legal perspective. One would require the Judicial Council to develop a separate process by which someone could challenge an EIR for such a project. So those are some of the types of pieces of legislation that we've seen. The third page, we've got some drought legislation. AB1, the first bill on this list, would simply say during a declared state of emergency due to drought, any fine for not watering your lawn is null and void. So no local government could fine you for having a brown lawn under those certain circumstances. Still, again, quite a few of the spot bill scenario here. The one I have highlighted and bolded and underlined in the other category relates specifically to the Water Commission. Senator Wolk has a bill, and I did speak to her staff, and I believe they were going to try and contact commission staff also. It would basically declare when you have a disqualifying financial interest, you are to recuse yourself, and if it is determined, if the Attorney General, it allows the Attorney General to bring charges against you for doing such, and if so, if found that is the case, to forfeit office on your way to jail. That's current status. I haven't had any significant conversation with them other than we had a brief conversation, and they did indicate they were going to be contacting your staff, so hopefully those contacts have been made.
Hey, Casey, on that, maybe it's from Maureen too. Is there anything in the bill that's inconsistent with existing law, or is it just stating it more emphatically for us to be aware of it?
Your legal counsel.
It's not so much inconsistent with existing law, but it's adding to existing penalties for those infractions because removal from the commission is not currently one of the penalties that would follow.
So same requirements for disqualification, increased penalty specifically for us.
Right.
Got it.
And that particular act that the Wolk bill cross-references is one in which there's both parallel tracks for civil and criminal prosecution. So it's already has substantial penalties. I think this, in some ways, is something lesser than what it already does.
Got it.
So as I said, this is the list that have been introduced. The policy committee process is going to kick off in earnest following spring recess, which I believe begins on the 27th for the legislature, is when they'll be out for the following week after that. And then the policy committees will begin hearing these bills or some version of these bills, ones that still need some formal language placed in them will need to be amended either by the committee or by the authors for those hearings. And that process, like I said, starts there in the 1st of April, the second week of April, though, is when that process is going to begin for hearing these bills. And I know there's quite a few on here. Again, if you have questions, I can do my best. I have a few notes as to what some of these are, but I don't have a great depth as to what some of these are if you have detailed questions.
Any not very detailed questions?
Well, there was one related to Proposition 1 on the previous slide. Do you know what the Gallagher bill?
311, AB 311 in the infrastructure piece. Mm-hmm. I show that's... Or am I looking at the right one?
I think so, yeah.
My notes show that is the one that requires the Judicial Council to develop a process to challenge a water project that has been funded by Prop 1. And again, it also defines what a water project means for the purposes of that bill.
Okay, thanks.
Any more questions for Casey? Great. Thank you, Casey.
Any suggestions on the next PowerPoint presentation, how it should be?
Yeah, black on blue, I'm not sure. Yeah.
Sorry.
That's the blue. Yeah. Yeah, I have a suggestion.
That we get it into the book,
yeah,
and sure. So that we can refer to that and also highlight the ones that you pointed out that might be the most concern to us.
Sure.
That would be helpful.
What I'll also make sure is I'll doctor this up and get this to the staff to make sure it can be sent out to you so you can have it for reference.
Thank you.
Okay, great. Thank you very much, Casey.
Thank you.
All right, so I'm appropriate now to be indicating that we're going to take a break for lunch, and we will reconvene at 1:30.
And we'll reconvene in room 340.
Oh, I'm sorry. We're going to reconvene in room 340. I know everyone get that? Reconvene in 340.
Whether they would qualify as public benefits solely without meeting the